From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we'll go over the results of yesterday's primary elections and look ahead to what we can expect between now and November. Later, the organizers of India Fest hope to build on last year's success.
We really didn't know what we were getting into. We just jumped into it, and then we said, if it is small, also we'll just keep going on and keep the ball rolling, and that's what it happened.
A retired Lutheran pastor hopes to spur some environmental awakenings at a folk school. And a local mystery writer remembers his introduction to Milwaukee crime.
My parents used to take us to the Shorecrest Hotel for dinner, and they pointed out a telephone on a table, which was Frank Ballastreri's notorious phone that was eventually tapped. So I got some look into that world.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Good morning. Welcome to Wednesday morning. As you just heard in our newscast, results are in from yesterday's primary election races, and winners have been declared in all the key races in the region. The most recent news coming across the wires this morning is that the last undecided race, the 6th Congressional District GOP primary, has now been declared for Glenn Grothman over Joe Liebman, but by just over 200 votes, which will likely trigger a recount. And as is often the case in a midterm primary election, turnout was generally light in most parts of the state. Joining us this morning via phone to help us analyze the results is Julia Azari. She's an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, also the author of a recent book called Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So your most recent book is about mandates, and maybe mandates are a good place to start, or maybe lack thereof. Turnout is never especially high in primary elections, but if you are a winning candidate, how much can you read into the attitude of the electorate when only a fifth of registered voters cast ballots?
I think it's very challenging to read into the electorate in any under any circumstances. And I also think that it's tough to do that in the context of the primary, where so much comes down to personalities and to advertising and to quirky idiosyncratic factors. But actually, I was just thinking that I thought that for our local election, turnout and interest in this one was actually pretty high. So that maybe tells us something about the state of American political participation at the local level.
Well, and in many ways, it's always like this, right? We hear that primary election candidates have to appeal to the party faithful and then often change their approach to appeal to a wider cross-section of voters in the fall.
Right. That's true in some contexts, for sure. One place where we'll see that play out is the Wisconsin 6th, I think, to some extent. That's a conservative district, a Republican district, but we did see Grothman win that primary, and I think that in order to appeal to he's going to need to appeal to a much broader section of voters than some of his comments and issue positions would suggest. In Milwaukee, that's not as much true. You have a totally different dynamic when you have Democratic primaries within cities.
Right. They often become de facto general elections, especially let's take a look at the election in the Milwaukee County Sheriff's race. This was a Democratic primary, but it was very much a de facto general election. The incumbent and winner was David Clark, who reportedly had many Republicans crossing over to vote for him.
Yeah, it's true. It's kind of an unusual, you know, it's kind of a strange phenomenon from the perspective of the kind of democracy you learn about in grade school when you're learning about civics. It's not uncommon in urban areas, though. I'm looking to kind of compare us with what happened in Washington, D.C. and in 2012 in their primary, because that's another city where the Democratic primary is the election. And it looks like their April 2012 primary had around the same number of votes as the sheriff's race did in Milwaukee County, about 50,000 votes.
A lot had been made of the hundreds of thousands of dollars spent in this race, but I wonder if this also speaks to the priceless value of incumbency as well.
I think that that's probably true, and that name recognition is going to be really important in this kind of election where there are relatively few other information cues because it's two Democrats. At the same time, this race, I thought the sheriff's race was very heavy on information cues for a local primary. You know, you had both sides talking about Clark as the NRA candidate, which has a very kind of concise, symbolic value. It's also pretty astounding, I think, that this race attracted so much national attention. Again, I kind of go back to D.C. primaries in terms of races where you have an urban Democratic primary that attracts national attention. And I think because Wisconsin has been so much in the news in terms of national politics, and because police issues and racial issues and gun issues have been in the news so much, this race took on a kind of broader significance, and you can kind of see that in the tenor of the campaign and also, I think, in the results of the race.
Right. We had heard that that Michael Bloomberg had contributed a lot of money to this race and essentially really tried to make it a referendum on gun laws. Is that going to be the rule more than the exception for years to come, that we're going to see these outside sources of money in things like, very local, very urban races attempting to shape the results?
So I think part of that is the result of the continued relaxation of campaign finance laws over the last couple of years and the last couple court decisions. I also think there's a kind of dynamic where the parties have become more deeply nationalized in the last 5 years or so, and where local and state level races have garnered national attention, where we have these kind of symbolic issues that tie areas of the country together. At the same time, I also see some countervailing forces there and some politicians who are motivated to keep issues and debates local. So I think we're going to kind of see some back and forth, but I do think that Wisconsin in particular can expect to be this kind of target of national attention when it comes to some of these kind of deeply politicized questions.
The other dynamic that many had said was at work in the sheriff's race was the influence of conservative talk radio in boosting the Clark candidacy. Is there a comparison to be made to the latter part of the 19th century when there were, scores of daily newspapers in every city, many of them essentially mouthpieces for a particular political viewpoint?
There certainly is a kind of dynamic where we used to have a very partisan media environment, as you said, in the 19th century. And then in the 20th century, we kind of developed this norm about more objective and removed journalism, not part of the two parties. And now we're kind of going back. I think that's a dynamic that's true across a lot of different aspects of the political system. So that might be one.
Another race that got considerable attention, at least as far as a midterm primary goes, was Assembly District 19, in which there was this four-way race on the Democratic side. The best known of the candidates was County Board Chairwoman Marina Dmitrievich, but she lost out by a couple of hundred votes to political newcomer Jonathan Brostoff. Is this perhaps a sign that name recognition is not everything, especially when you have four candidates vying?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I'm still kind of puzzling through what happened in the 19th. So, my apologies for not having a quicker line. I actually don't live in the 19th, but I live very close to it. So I've been trying to observe the signage that I've been seeing and kind of where I see which signs. And I definitely saw a lot of Brostoff signs, but not as many as Dmitrievich. So, that kind of is a very unscientific way to observe things, but that kind of speaks to your name recognition point. I do think that there's a kind of dynamic in the last 5 years or so, particularly, as the economy hasn't been great, as the recovery hasn't been great, as the, for urban areas, outcomes haven't been great, especially. While incumbency is an advantage, there are these sort of really notable moments where it's not, and where people have leaned toward the kind of new faces and new blood.
And we should note that Dmitrievich was not an incumbent in this race, but certainly an incumbent office holder that was well known in the district.
Right. That's what I mean. I'm sorry. I should have clarified. Right. So she is a kind of she's sort of mainstay. But yeah, I mean, I saw her as sort of the establishment candidate in this race. I also think I will say this as far as partisan dynamics. I think the establishment insurgent debate is pretty established. Pretty established in the Republican Party. The dynamics of that for Republicans, I think, are clear. For Democrats, they're less clear. And as we look into 2016 and, going on the national level, I think that this is an issue where analysts are just starting to get a read on how Democratic voters view these issues. Democratic voters are just getting a read on kind of these questions of the establishment heir apparent type candidates and the less experienced candidates.
So looking at the top of the ticket, Mary Burke easily won the Democratic nomination to run against Scott Walker this fall for governor. The latest polls are showing it could be a very tight race. What's your sense for how Mary Burke has done in terms of name recognition around the state? That was the rub pretty early on, that she just wasn't very well known.
That's really one of the major obstacles that she had to overcome. And the other thing that's interesting is how she positions herself as this kind of candidate who has the private sector experience with her family's company.
Well, and this was really what's interesting, I think, is this was a primary race that was kind of already determined. So I wonder if it goes against that maxim that primary candidates have to refine their message once the primaries are done. She's really been running against Scott Walker for a while, not other Democrats.
Right. And that's often how primaries have gone in the last couple of decades at the higher levels, right? The higher stakes races. Often the party sort of grooms the candidate, and anyone else who's running is just they're kind of a hanger on, and that's really I think what parties and candidates would most prefer, which again isn't very democratic, right? So I think Burke and the Democrats have been pretty focused and on message with regard to that, and I think that Burke has come up with a message that has at least helped her name recognition and kind of helped her gain some appeal in the Wisconsin electorate, which is why we're seeing such close polls.
Well, and are there storylines you think we ought to look closely at in the coming weeks as that race comes into focus?
One thing to think about is how much this is going to be a referendum on Scott Walker. That's the obvious narrative when you're running against any incumbent, especially if you're running against a very polarizing incumbent. However, Democrats will wisely be concerned about the fact that the times that they've tried to have a negative retrospective campaign against Walker back in 2012, it didn't work in the recall. So I think that there may need to be a little more emphasis on a kind of what would a Burke administration look like and give people kind of a vision of an alternative and not just, what's bad about Walker, because that's ultimately a message that through TV advertising and that kind of thing, that kind of message is often not as inspiring to get people to turn out.
Well, and you would have to think that that from a competitiveness standpoint, the Walker campaign would have liked a more bruising Democratic primary electoral campaign.
I think that's quite possibly true, especially if it had been divisive. On the other hand, a bruising primary campaign can also really draw a lot of media attention, so that can actually boost name recognition for the other candidates. I think the jury's out on the impact of a divisive primary. But on the other hand, I think it's hard to say that the relative smoothness of the Burke campaign is a drawback. That really the thing that anyone who's interested in the outcome of that race ought to be thinking about is turnout. That is the major difference in Wisconsin between the political outcomes in a presidential year and a midterm year, turnout. And the groups that don't turn out in higher numbers in a midterm tend to be the groups that have a tendency to vote Democratic. Younger voters, minority voters, people of lower income. So
you would imagine between now and then the Democrats are going to undertake a fairly substantial get out the vote effort.
I think so, and I think Mary Burke has hired some good on the ground political professionals, and I think that's really the lesson of the last couple of years, and with the Obama campaign, has really been about ground game. As people call it, about sending people out into the field to register and mobilize voters and get people to the polls. It's unclear. Studies have shown different things about whether negative ads motivate people. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they just affirm for people who think politics is really bad business. They just affirm that view and inspire people to stay home. So, TV ads are good for name recognition and for establishing a narrative, but having people on the ground tends to be what gets people to the polls.
A lot of interesting storylines to look ahead to. Julia Azari, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Julia Azari is assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. Her most recent book is called Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate. She joined us by phone. Coming up next on the program, after a successful first run, India Fest Milwaukee looks ahead to its second year. We'll get a preview when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Like Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. We're in the midst of ethnic festival season in Milwaukee. Events such as Polish Fest, German Fest, and Festa Italiana have already passed. Many are looking ahead to Irish Fest this weekend or Mexican Fiesta next weekend. But Milwaukee is home to many smaller festivals that are lesser known, but no less significant to ethnic communities around the region. This Saturday, Humboldt Park hosts the second annual India Fest Milwaukee. The all-day affair comes the day after India celebrates its annual Independence Day and features Indian food, music, and even a fashion show. Pranima Nath is the president of Spindle India, the organization planning the festival. She tells Lake Effect Dan Harmon that she hopes this year's version of the event builds on some of the success India Fest had in its first incarnation.
I think it went really well last year. We expected about a couple thousand people coming through. It's solely because we didn't have a whole lot of time for marketing and advertising, and a lot of people didn't know. And we had exactly 8 weeks from the conception of when we started thinking about doing it and when we actually executed it. Obviously, we don't have a scale to measure how many people came over, but it was a floating population almost between 4,000 to 5,000 people. At any given point of time, we had 15 to 2,000 people in the park. So that was surprising to us. The other one, obviously, we didn't expect so many people, and we couldn't imagine how people liked Indian food a lot. And we had 40, 50 people standing in front of one food booth. It was really awesome to see. And I wish there was a lot more at that time.
I was there, and I remember those lines. Yes, it is hard to gauge because Humboldt Park, people just come and go. There is no gate, right?
Right.
So that's just a kind of a visual estimation.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, are there going to be more food vendors this year?
They're interested, yes. And we'll see how it turns out this year, too. So we're really hoping to have a lot more varieties and varieties of food as well.
Okay. Yeah, eight weeks is not a lot of time to plan a pretty huge event.
No, it was not. We really didn't know what we were getting into. We just jumped into it, and then we said, if it is small, also we'll just keep going on and keep the ball rolling, and that's what it happened. I think it gained popularity, even if it was the last 7 days that people got to know. I think that's what helped us.
I think what makes this interesting is that we talked to you last year, and it was new last year, so this is only the second festival.
Yeah.
So we're going to be going along with you as you know we find out what works and what doesn't work. So did anything not work last year besides there weren't enough food vendors?
Well, I think, we had a pretty tight schedule as well. We were pretty on time when we started our program, and on the dot we finished. There were a couple of cancellations the last moment in the program. Thankfully, we had worked it out in some way or the other. But I think this time we're a bit more cautious in terms of cancellations. So we're making sure that that happens prior. So we have lineup of programs. We already do. So I'm very confident that things are going to work out better.
And last year you had a dance. There were dance lessons, right?
There were. We thought of doing a dance lesson, but it ultimately didn't work out, and just in terms of logistics and availability of the right people. We are thinking of doing a couple of interesting things this time. Let's see if that works out.
Like what? Yeah. Like, dance-related or just something new? Yeah.
No, I've met a gentleman, a Sikh gentleman, and he was very interested to have a booth to tie, to show how to tie turban, because it's different. And he said that it's such a long cloth and people usually is wondering how to wear him. So he was very interested to have a tent for showing how to tie the turban, the Sikh gentleman. So I was interested. So let's see how that works out. I think that's quite interesting to me.
You don't get that at every festival.
I know. And there are a couple other things we are trying to do. I've tried last year because of the resources, manpower, and also like time. I couldn't, you know, spend a whole lot of time to get that done. I'm hoping this will can do that this year. So one of the things that I was hoping and envisioning was to have several regional committees, like, you know, southern committees and northern committees, to have information booth type of thing where they can talk about their regions and talk about their history and what they are. It's more than just food and dance, right? So I'm talking to several associations, like, you know, the Tamil associations called Greater Milwaukee Tamil Sangam. They are very interested. Talking to the Telugu side, I'm talking to the Marathi and Punjab, you know, in Bengalis as well. So we'll see how that comes through. What I'm envisioning is there is going to be one section where that information pavilion is going to be there around the regions, so people can get some ideas about the histories and major players in those area and things like that.
Last year, I know there was a cricket demonstration.
Yes.
Is that going to reappear?
This year, we're not so sure if we're going to do the cricket, because what we saw last year was we ended our program at 6 o'clock to have the cricket match. But our experience was that people were so enthusiastic about where they were at that time. They were still sitting there until 8:30, 9 o'clock. The food stall was still open until then. So they're still expecting programs to happen until then. So whoever was on the ground, they were still on the ground. So that's why we have increased our timeline this year, and we're going to give a evening program. So I think that's what people expected last year. So we'll give them this year.
All right. So officially it will go into 9 p.m.?
Is that 10 p.m.
10 p.m. Wow.
Yes.
Okay. Let's talk about music. I mean, that's the big part of it. Are these performers that are all Milwaukee-based, or are people coming in from other places?
Actually, majority from Milwaukee, but we have targeted people in Madison area and Chicago and everywhere. So this our communication has gone to Midwest. So any and everybody is welcome. But for now, what we have seen is majorly here, Madison, and some from Chicago area.
What kinds of music?
We will showcase a traditional and Bollywood. So we want to give them, you know, the regional music as well, and the traditional side, and also the Bollywood side.
And I've noticed you handed me a sheet before we went on, and I noticed there's quite a few new sponsors. Is that... That's a good sign, right?
This year?
Yeah.
Yes, of course. I think it's very hard to get a sponsor. You know, initially last year, obviously, it was very difficult for us to talk what we are trying to accomplish. And still, we were able to, acquire 13 of them. And I thank them from bottom of my heart to believe. So they believed in us when we had just concept. This year, we have solid information. This is what happened. We have some numbers that we could talk to them, saying, hey, this many people came around. This is what we have done. You know, this is the response from the community. So they have a solid example. So we're able to. It was a lot easier this year. And plus, we had gotten a little bit more time, too, right? Last year, we crunched everything in 8 weeks. This year we got 1.5 month extra, which helps.
The first one I saw on there was Air India, which, yes, I think that's pretty huge to get them as a sponsor.
Oh, thank you. They were pretty generous. Actually, when they came over last year as a chief guest, I actually talked to them, would you like to be our sponsor next year? So right. I already gave a buzz to them. So after the event, I kept talking to them, and then they were able to help us out.
Great, yeah. And, you know, Harley Davidson, they're on there, and that's great.
Yes, that was a little challenging, but yes, we worked it out somehow.
Well, anything that's going to be new this year?
I have tried several other things. I was trying to pursue a band, the school bands. for the parade that we would do. The only thing is that because of the school, is right now school is not there, so it is becoming very hard for me to connect with somebody to get the bands come over. I have reached out to several other schools and not getting the right response because, A, you know, they're not there to, you know, it's just timeline doesn't work for them and things like that. But I'm still trying. I think that's going to be really, really nice. And other thing that we're going to do is we're going to do a professional music band. So that's going to be a new thing for us. And we're going to do the hopefully several states agree with us and come and show their artifacts and, you know, people and talk about their history. That pavilion that I was referring to you earlier, I think that is going to be quite nice for people from all areas to know. It's kind of give you information about what India is about if somebody has not gone.
And, of course, the big thing is that it's going to last 4 hours longer,
yes.
Officially.
Right? Yes.
Purnima Nath, thank you for coming in. I hope it goes well this year. Hopefully we'll have more to talk about next year.
Thank you. Thank you for the wishes.
Purnima Nath is producer and chairperson of India Fest Milwaukee 2014. It runs all day Saturday at Milwaukee's Humboldt Park. She spoke with Dan Harmon. A gathering coming soon in Ozaukee County calls on the tradition of so-called folk schools to make some environmental and spiritual awakenings. We'll meet the guiding force when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. To describe June Eastvold as a spunky octogenarian and retired evangelical Lutheran church campus pastor only skims the surface of the woman. Today, Port Washington is her habitat, but Eastvold's life has taken her from Milwaukee to the Pacific Northwest. Social justice and activism followed her along the way. More recently, Eastvold spearheaded what she would describe as an environmental stewardship spiritual awakening event based in Port Washington. Now in its third year, the New Wind Folk School will kick off its latest three-day cycle this Friday. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bent sat down with Eastvold on her shaded deck earlier this week. You'll pick up on her sense of urgency immediately as she explains the upcoming event and the 18th century Danish roots of the folk school concept. But first, Eastvold wanted to know how much time she'd be given to tell the New Wind story.
How much air time?
I think it'll end up being 12 minutes, maybe.
12 minutes. Ooh, there's a lot to put into my 12 minutes.
I know, but don't think about
it. I'll try.
Just talk. No, just talk.
And then you'll
and
edit
I'll
out.
Edit.
Be
yeah.
sure you keep the best part.
Okay, so tell me about this year's. We're into the third cycle.
We're into the third cycle. And when this all started up it started up centuries ago, actually, but we're in this location. It was 3 years ago. And one of the main questions that started coming up is, what is a folk school? We don't understand that. That's an alien concept to us, you know. Is it for preschool, or do you get a certification? Or no, it's for enrichment. It's education for enrichment.
So this model exists, goes back, as you said, for a long,
into
long way.
Into the 1700s, yeah. N.F.S. Grundtvig. Oh, I love that. I love to say N.F.S. Grundtvig.
So people can look that up because our listeners are so bright. But
no,
today, are you going to take us there? Okay.
Oh, I'm taking him. All right, so N.F.S. Grundtvig. Complicated man, gorgeous man, so prophetic. Way back in the 1700s. Who identified we are part and parcel, species in a chain of a miracle, a marvelous, a cherished inheritance that comes to us to celebrate, to care for, to give back to. During the Civil Rights Movement, Pete Seeger and with Rosa Parks and with all these people that were in that movement got it all from the model of the Danish folk school tradition, based entirely on that concept of the holistic, interrelational, collective accountability, celebration, courage, and living the truth strong. And yet having a lot of fun. And they're all there in the community. The community. The community. The giving, not the competitive.
So that's what you're after. In the folk school here coming up is reinforcing, creating, expanding community.
Oh, absolutely. The concept was this, is this, and it's very simple. But we make it very complex and very difficult. Everybody's hysterical about the economy. There is no economy apart from Earth. And when we are wasteful and abusive and destructive, it's like humankind is committing its own genocide. It is at a counter energy. When we give back to the earth, when we honor and adore and love and respect the power, when you go through this state, for example, the abundance, the over generosity that is here, our economy is earth, the water, the soil, the beauty, the magnificent. We didn't, you know, close the book, slam the cannon shut, and say creation was over after 7 days. Oh, my, it's daily. The miracles just, you know. And yet every day we're systematically going after the destruction of our economy by destroying Earth, which is our economy. We don't get it. We don't get it. Then we have this other notion that we are in command, able to improve, advance, and move into a better world, a better future, because we are superior to the chain that is nature. We think that we're original, that we're independent, and we're stuck in a lie. We keep repeating the lie. We keep believing the lie that keeps us from opening up a new reality that is truth, that we must tell, we must hear, we must recognize.
So is part of the point the belief that we as humans can control, we can handle, we can manage our environment, our world?
Yeah. That we are in the superior position. And we mix up this old adage that we are given dominion, domination, that we are something other than the natural chain of interdependent species. And then we begin to understand there comes a revelation, a discovery, that we aren't at the top of the pyramid. That when we are wasteful, or when the river runs dry, we turn to dust. Because we are nature. And what we do in our attitude and our use and our waste and our destruction is all catapulting us into death and destruction and the darkness.
Yes. So what can the folk school, what can that do to refocus?
You see, because it's for those who are seeking. They are the pilgrims. That's what we're calling it this year, the pilgrims. We had a controversy. I do listen to the steering community. They don't think I do, but we had not an argument, but a bit of a break in our, because for me, pilgrim is the ancient idea, you know, of going to the sacred ground, of the discipline of going to Mecca or going to Rome or going to some place where a saint healed somebody, and, you know, that this is a pilgrimage. I've been on many of these. I went from Paris to Santiago on the way, you know, to St. James. That was something, I'll tell you. Well, anyway, I've been on a lot of these pilgrimages things, and the group said, well, now, wait a minute, you don't have to have a sacred ground, and you don't have to go someplace. You know, we could take a pilgrimage down our own river. You know, there's a lot of people that go in search or are exploring or have a pilgrimage, you know? I don't know. You're going to mess it up. But if that's what you want to do, I mean, let's do it. Well, now I'm really excited about it. I really want to go on the pilgrimage and the river.
So what brought the transitional moment for you, the enlightenment that you are now excited about this idea?
Well, I'm not the only one that's got something going here, and I ought to trust that people who have lived in these waters and been in this place and in this county and with the mentality that it's moving around here. It isn't really June's folk school here. We're opening it. We're exploring. We're discovering. We're on a pilgrimage.
And
then we have Orcutt, who's coming here with her book on climate change. She will put it there. In years and years of study with people in all of these fields that she has researched, she has brought into perspective, she'll say, this is where we are. This is where we need to be, and this is what we have to do. And then, of course, we have the poets, and we have the troubadours, we have the music, we have the singing of the Danish songs, we have the... There is no movement ever, ever that has been in our world that has not had its song. The song the people lift up and sing. I got a hammer, I'm hammering in the morning. We shall overcome. Hey, what about that hymn? What about that empowerment? That strength? So this is going way over 12 minutes.
It's okay, it's fabulous stuff. One could say, June, you have given your life to your ministry to...
I would prefer to say, my ministry has given me life.
Okay, taking that into account. You could sit here in your treehouse, write another book, invite people to come and visit, and just relax. But you're not about to do that.
Well, that's because... If we are to break out of these desires that have been fed into us, that have been indoctrinated, if we have gotten over this, you know, as we said during the Depression years, give them two cars in the garage, let them eat cake, and I would add and give them a full season of tickets to the Brewers. Keep them happy.
So you think we've been lulled into just sort of relax and don't make a fuss?
Accepting, you know, we're not good people. We're sinful and we're unclean and we break the rules. And so I have one little thing I want to just throw in here. It was something came over the internet. Usually don't spend a lot of time on it. This is what the folk school is really hitting toward. It was a classroom, and the instructor was saying to the students, I want you to list the seven wonders of the world. So they were very busy making their list, judging, voting for what they considered. Well, there's Egypt's pyramids, Taj Mahal, the Great Canyon, the Panama Canal, the Empire State Building, St. Peter's Basilica, China's Great Wall. So they were going to vote, and if they all agreed, these were the seven great wonders of the world. And there was one student that was still not getting it together. She was kind of having trouble, and so the guy looked at her, and he said, are you having difficulty listing the... Yeah, there's so many of them. I don't know. I guess, well, what I got is the seven wonders of the world are to see... To hear, to touch, to feel, to laugh, to taste, to love. That's what the folk school is all about.
Retired Lutheran pastor June Eastfold is one of the guiding forces between the New Wind Folk School, which runs August 15th through the 17th in Ozaukee County. That means it starts on Friday. She spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. Incidentally, the Orcutt Eastfold mentioned is author Andrea Orcutt. She'll be discussing her book Restoring Earth, Community, and Soul at this year's rendition of the Folk School. There are more details at WUWM.com/lake effect. Yesterday's rain made for a nice respite in a dry period this summer, but rain was the rule and not the exception in a recent murder mystery by a Milwaukee area author. We'll hear about Summer of Rain when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. The rain and fog earlier this week have lifted, but if you enjoyed them, a recent mystery by a local author might be just the meteorological ticket. The Summer of Rain, Odyssey of a Young PI, plays out in a fictional Wisconsin town during a profoundly damp summer. The investigator is Bobby Broyles, new to the job and a man who finds himself wrapped up in a soggy morass of corruption, murder, scandal, and slimy funeral directors. The hard-boiled mystery is the work of the mild-mannered John Kolb of Whitefish Bay, who has previously written plays and short stories. He sat down with us in June and talked about what makes a good mystery for him.
Well, certainly suspense, as the name goes. I also like good dialogue. It's one of my favorite parts of writing as a writer and a reader. And then I like characters that are memorable. So those are some of the ingredients that I was hoping to put into my book.
From what I know about you, and I don't know a ton about you, but I don't believe you were a part of the culture of corruption and crime syndicates and drugs and snitches. what draws you to writing about that world?
I led a pretty sedate life. I went to grade school, was born, and lived within about a two-block area. I guess my first introduction to Milwaukee crime, my parents used to take us to the Shorecrest Hotel for dinner, and they pointed out a telephone on a table, which was Frank Balistrieri's notorious phone that was eventually tapped. So I got some look into that world. But I guess it's more – I like reading books that have strong dialogue, and I like the noir world, both movies and fiction. So that kind of got me interested in trying to mimic some of the better ones.
Who are the detective and mystery writers who have been important to you through the years?
Well, there's a guy that not everybody knows. The late his name was Westlake, but he wrote under the name of Richard Stark. He wrote a series. I like that very much. Recently, a literary fiction writer named Dennis Johnson wrote something called Nobody Move that's really nice. And then movies like Chinatown and the earlier noir ones were all kind of models for me.
I detected kind of a Raymond Chandler quality to this as well.
Well, he certainly everybody owes a debt to him, and I've read some of his and some of the others down to Elmore Leonard. I haven't read all of anybody's.
As I read it, one of the – not to harp on the Raymond Chandler thing, but I remember reading something about the making of The Big Sleep, and by the end, not even the people that were working on that movie knew who had done it and how. And there was certainly something in the really tangled web that we read about in this book that was intriguing.
Well, it was a while before I knew how it was going to end. I kind of dove into it. I had a character, a situation in mind, and I was really sort of desperately searching for how to conclude it. And then when I got the idea, I had to go back and fix some things up to make it a little more plausible.
Well, so let's talk about that. How did this story or where did this story start for you?
Well, years ago, I was in a small writing group, and this is about 20 years ago. The owner of Von Trier's on the east side was assassinated in his parking lot with a crossbow, a very bizarre kind of crime that I don't think was ever solved. So the four of us thought, hey, we should be rich and famous. Let's write a mystery. And I was the only one who did it. So I did that. And then I did a second one about a young detective just starting out in this field. And then I set that aside and a couple years ago totally rewrote that. So that's how I kind of got introduced to the idea of writing crime fiction.
Well, and where did Bobby Broyles come from?
Different places, the fact of having a factory accident and then starting his life over mirrored something that happened at a place where I worked. A young man did get injured, and the company paid for him to go back to school and start his life over. And I kind of like that.
Not necessarily as a detective, though.
No, actually as a computer programmer, which makes it hard to have a central character doing computer programming. But no, but so that was kind of one model. Another thing was in Chinatown – for the second half of the movie, the hero has a bandage over his nose, which is kind of a reminder that he's not in control and the world is dangerous. So the idea of having my hero have a scar, if you will, of the dangerous world came into mind also.
Well, and so what sets this book in motion? Paint a picture of where things are, both for Bobby and what he's setting out to accomplish and solve as the book opens. We don't want to give too much away because part of the fun of the book is seeing the twists and turns, but give us what sets the thing in motion.
Well, one thing that I hope is a little different in this book is that Bobby is trying to start over, but he keeps going back to his parents to try and have them bless what he's doing, and they have different ideas of what he should be doing. So his mother has ambitions for him beyond the factory. His father says, why isn't it good enough for you?
But his father was also at the factory.
Correct. He's kind of a minor technical star at the factory. And Bobby's comfortable. But his mother always implies he should do something else. And so Bobby has that in his head. So when that comes together with this accident and some money, that's kind of what turns him to trying something new. And he doesn't have a college education. So this is something he can try out.
How much did you like Bobby when you started putting him on paper?
I actually did like him. I had some feedback in writing groups of this guy is kind of wimpy, and early on he does stumble around. But I kind of wanted him to be like that. I wanted him to not be like Humphrey Bogart, always in kind of command and control, sort of lost. And so I did like him. He's certainly not totally admirable. He hopefully is a mixed person that readers will enjoy following and find interesting, but he has his flaws.
And he's certainly learning the ropes as he goes here.
Absolutely. Stumbling. And when he first got into it, I mean, in the real world, he probably would have spent 10 years staking out motels and nothing. And it's just sort of a fluke that he gets pulled into something that's more substantial than that, namely the disappearance of the wife of a kind of mysterious businessman. Pretty important to have a little more drama than what the average private investigator actually does all the time.
Well, and it's his good fortune that he's been hired, because this is a guy who is perfectly happy to keep paying him to look for his missing wife.
As bad a detective as he is originally, he's still getting paid well and wrestles with some of the dilemmas that involves. He's aware that he's kind of a bought person and doesn't know where he's going and kind of wonders, why am I getting paid, but I'm glad I am.
And he finds himself in a situation where he's working with a cop who is also kind of new to the scene, or at least new to this city.
Yeah, they kind of pair up. He pairs up with a couple people. He has a lawyer friend who's struggling in his life, but he also has this cop that is new and trying to find his way in a new town. And they're sort of kind of partners and kind of adversaries. So they work together.
Bobby spends a lot of his time getting beaten up.
He does get beaten up often, and he's pretty resilient. He awakes in hospital rooms any number of times, looks around and wonder what's going on, and asks himself, should I keep trying this? And just one other thing that kind of eventually got into my head was to have him at least, well, it's, I think, a light, good read. There is this theme of guilt, because as he keeps stumbling around, he keeps endangering people around him. It's almost like a Job as things are crashing around him, and he wrestles with, you know, should I get out of this? I'm hurting other people. That's a theme that runs through it. Not too heavy, I don't think, but it brings a little moral issue to it.
Well, and as you say, you didn't necessarily have a solution in mind when you began. How much fixing did you have to do as you went along to make sure that there weren't all sorts of continuity flaws? This is a really tangled web you have woven.
Yes, it is tangled. And I did, as I say, I did have to go back. And there are certain scenes that absolutely I had to tweak to make it, by the end, the total surprise. I think it's a total surprise. I haven't yet had anybody say I saw that coming.
And there are no buttons. butlers in this book.
There are
no
butlers in there, and there's no Mr. Plum or any of that.
There's a reference to Mr. Plum, as I recall.
There is a joking reference to that, yeah. But so I had to go back and try to make it, because as I thought about it, I did wrestle with, is anybody going to believe that this could be it? And I hopefully, by retracing it, I fixed it, I think.
Why did you decide against setting this book in Milwaukee? The actual setting is a bit ambiguous, but it is a small city somewhere in the Midwest.
First of all, I knew if I specifically named a town, I'd have to be really careful, and I like the freedom of not having to do that. If there is a town that, as I thought about it afterwards, my mother grew up in Marinette, Wisconsin, and there was an article in the paper recently about the sudden explosion of the drug trade in Marinette, Wisconsin, and that kind of mirrored what goes on in my story, is that it's surely as Bobby is having growing pains, the town is having growing pains as suddenly crime is escalating in a once kind of innocent place. So I like the freedom of not actually naming it, and I could invent stuff that seemed to work for me.
Did you have to do – there are a couple of sidebars or tangents that the book goes into, and one is this world of funeral directors, yeah, that Bobby finds himself in. How did you immerse yourself in that world?
You've named some of my favorite characters, the funeral directors, and I – apologies to all real funeral directors. I don't really know what you're like, and you're probably not like these people. And so there again, I maybe was freed by ignorance that I could just kind of imagine that maybe some of them have a public persona that isn't exactly the same as what they say behind the scenes. And yet I'm sure I exaggerated. So, I mean, there are probably plenty of people and ethnic groups that get insulted in my book. I really don't mean it.
It is probably not giving anything away to say that Bobby survives this mystery. Is he going to ride again?
First of all, I'd like some overwhelming demands from my fans to do a sequel. It hasn't happened yet, but I have started. I've put about 40, 50 pages down on paper. So I have some thoughts of maybe doing it again. I do allow him to live, yes, so we can go on. If a trilogy is needed, I'm ready.
Well, it seems like just from reading it, you must have had an awfully good time writing it.
It was fun. The dialogue was fun. I loved doing characters and not being under the obligation to have a huge amount of depth to them, painting them in a brush stroke or two, and that's kind of what I enjoyed. And I like the colloquial language, too. I like writers who write in that, dramatists or short story writers or whatever.
Did you go out for Latvian food when it was all over?
The names came from a couple guys I knew in high school, but I did not. No, I don't know if there is one in town, in fact. There probably is.
Yeah. Well, John Kolb, it's a fun read. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Well, thanks for having me on and asking some good questions.
You bet. Whitefish Bay author John Kolb's recent book is called The Summer of Rain, Odyssey of a Young PI. Our interview first aired in June. That's the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, the connection between homelessness, housing programs, and HIV. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Coming up at noon today, it's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR in Boston. But stay tuned, because right now it's 11 o'clock and fresh air comes your way next.